Okay, chapter 19, we're going to talk about the red blood cell pathology. We're going to especially focus on the anemias, because that's where the board really loves to test you on. Now, in your handout, there's a nice description of the various findings that you can see within the blood. I'll let you read that on your own. I'm going to go straight to how do you handle an anemic patient. And I want you to refer to figure number 19-1. It's the classification of anemias based on the MCV. First thing I want you to notice at the top of the figure is, first you have to determine that the person is anemic. You've got to look at the hemoglobin and the hematocrit. For males, someone who's anemic will have a hemoglobin less than 13.5 or a hematocrit less than 41. Females, it's slightly lower, hemoglobin of 12, hematocrit of 36. Once you've determined somebody is anemic, the next lab value I want you to look at is the MCV. It's going to help you categorize the different lesions. It's going to help with your differential. So if you look at the first category over on the left-hand side of this table, if the MCV is less than 80, we classify that as a microcytic anemia. The top four in your differential is going to be iron deficiency, thalassemia, anemia of chronic disease, and sideroblastic anemia. If the MCV is between 80 and 100, we call that normocytic. That differential is going to be a lot larger. And to actually narrow that differential, we're going to use another test called the reticulocyte count. It's a measurement of how many young red blood cells has your bone marrow put into the peripheral circulation. It's a great marker of bone marrow function. So if you're anemic, your bone marrow should be pumping out cells left and right. So normally, if an anemic person is anemic, the reticulocyte count should be high. If the reticulocyte count is low, the problem is in the bone marrow. So take a look at the differential. If it's low, it's a marrow problem, marrow failure, aplastic anemia, myelofibrosis, or a tumor invading the marrow, renal failure, or also anemia of chronic disease. If the reticulocyte count is high, you've got to think of peripheral destruction or peripheral loss. So in other words, a person could have been in a trauma and they could have hemorrhaged. Or they could have peripheral destruction, like having sickle cell, a G6PD deficiency, hereditary spherocytosis, autoimmune hemolytic anemia, or paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. The last category on this table is on the right-hand side. If the MCV is over 100, we call it a macrocytic anemia. In this category, the most important one is megaloblastic anemia, either due to B12 or folate deficiency. Other things can also cause it, for instance, alcohol disease and so forth. But remember, megaloblastic for this category. Okay, that's how you handle somebody who has anemia. Let's go through each of these categories and talk about them in more detail. We will start with iron deficiency anemia. By definition, the person is deficient in iron. They're lacking it. I want you to take a look at some of the levels we're going to look at. First of all, under number B, ferritin is the physiologic storage form. That's how your body stores iron. So in iron deficiency, you're not going to have a lot of storage. You're going to have low levels of ferritin. Next thing I want you to take a look at is under number D. How is iron transported in the body? It's transported by binding proteins, especially transferrin. And we use a lab test called the TIBC. We call that the total iron binding capacity of the blood. It's another marker for anemia. Okay, let's talk about some of the causes of iron deficiency anemia. Well, you can see it in patients who have an increased, have a poor diet, people who are elderly, young children, or patients who are poor. You could see it in patients who have an increased demand, such as growing kids or pregnant females. And finally, you could see it in patients who have decreased absorption or blood loss. In the United States, blood loss is the most common. If they give you a young female who's got periods of 7 or 8 days in length, she's losing a lot of blood. She's probably going to become iron deficient. The other one is in the United States, we have a lot of colon pathology. So you always want to do a guaiac stool to see if they're losing blood from the GI tract. Okay, let's look at the sequence of events in iron deficiency. The first change that occurs is you have a decrease in storage of iron, so the ferritin goes down. If you did a bone marrow biopsy and stained it with Prussian blue, you'd see low, low levels of iron. The next thing that would occur is, you have decrease in the circulating iron, so the serum iron goes down. The iron binding capacity of the blood goes up. There's less iron, and your body produces more transferrin. And finally, you have a decreased percent saturation. The last change is the blood becomes microcytic. The MCV goes down. Now, I want you to take a look at chart number 19-2. This is the iron panel. And anytime you get a patient whose MCV is less than 80, they have a microcytic anemia, you always want to look at the iron table, the iron studies. That will help you differentiate iron deficiency from anemia of chronic disease, from thalassemia, from sideroblastic anemia. Let's take a look at iron deficiency. Classically, they have low serum iron levels, elevated TIBC, low percent saturation, and low serum ferritin. Notice that this is different from the anemia of chronic disease, where the serum iron is the same, it's low. The TIBC now becomes low. Percent saturation is low, but the serum ferritin is usually sky high. Your body's been hoarding it in the anemia of chronic disease. Let's look at thalassemia. Everything is normal for thalassemia. Finally, sideroblastic anemia has its own pattern. Okay. Let's move on to the next microcytic anemia and talk specifically about the anemia of chronic disease. What's occurring in this disease is your macrophages are holding on to the iron. They're storing it in the form of ferritin and they're holding on to it. They're not releasing it into the serum. So the big difference in anemia of chronic disease from iron deficiency is that the ferritin is going to be elevated in these patients. Okay? That's the big difference. Now, they also have to give you a history of having a chronic disease, either rheumatoid arthritis, long-standing tuberculosis, osteomyelitis, Crohn's disease, cancer. They've got to give you a long-standing chronic disease. And what happens is due to the chronic inflammation, you have increased levels of cytokines, especially interleukin-1. And interleukin-1 is the substance that tells the macrophage to produce more ferritin. Okay, let's move on to thalassemia syndromes. In general, thalassemia is a quantitative problem in your globin chains, either the beta globin chain or the alpha globin chain. Okay, let's start off with alpha thalassemia. Remember that there are four alpha globin chains in the body. It's usually due to a deletion of one or more of these chains. So guess what? There are four chains. There are four different diseases under alpha thalassemia. If you delete one chain, we call those patients normal carriers or silent carriers. They've got one gene deletion. They're completely asymptomatic. They're not even anemic. If you delete two genes, we call that alpha thal minor or alpha thal trait. When you have a deletion of two chains, they only produce about 50% of the alpha chains required. There are two different forms. There's the cis form, which is found in Asians, and there's the trans form, which is found in blacks. Okay, if you delete three genes, we call that hemoglobin H disease. These patients become severely anemic. They only have one alpha chain, which produces only about 25% of the normal alpha chains. How will you make the diagnosis? Well, all of the beta hemoglobin is going to aggregate together and form hemoglobin H. It's basically four beta chains coming together and forming this hemoglobin H. You can detect that on hemoglobin electrophoresis. You will also form Heinz bodies, which can be detected on supravital stains. Finally, if you deflate all four alpha chains, that is incompatible with life. You will develop what's called hydrops fetalis, and you will die in utero or at the time of birth. What these patients will have is, well, they won't have any alpha chains, so all the gamma chains come together and you'll form gamma 4. That's also known as hemoglobin Barts. Okay, let's talk about beta thalassemia. There's a total of 2 beta globin genes. So guess what? There are 2 possible diseases in this category. Let's start with beta thal minor. This one tends to be mostly asymptomatic. They can have a mild anemia, especially if they get stressed. Clinically, what will you see? You will see a microcytic anemia with target cells. The cells tend to have an area that is dark in the center, makes that red cell look like a target. You can also see basophilic stippling on peripheral blood smear. Finally, if you do hemoglobin electrophoresis, you'll see an elevation in hemoglobin A2 and an elevation in hemoglobin F. Let's go on to beta thal major. This is a very, very serious disease. These patients are usually normal at birth, but about by 6 months, they start to become severely anemic. Their blood, their bone marrow, starts to try and pump out blood as best as it can. So you have erythrocytic hyperplasia within the bone marrow. These patients, the bone marrow actually will deform the bones. They can develop what's called a crew cut appearance to the skull on x-ray because the bone is now thickened. The maxilla can also become thickened, and they develop what's called a chipmunk facial features. Okay, in the peripheral blood, they tend to have a microcytic hyperchromic anemia. Again, they'll have target cells. They'll have basophilic stippling. On hemoglobin electrophoresis, they have an elevation in hemoglobin F. Usually, the hemoglobin F is about 90% of all the hemoglobin. They also have an elevation in hemoglobin A2 and a decrease in hemoglobin A. This is a severe disease. If you do not transfuse these patients ongoing, they will die. That's how severe their anemia is. So as a complication, these patients will often die in their late teenage years of hemochromatosis due to all the transfusions. Okay, let's move on to sideroblastic anemia. This is the last of the microcytic anemias. If you do a bone marrow biopsy, the characteristic finding are ringed sideroblasts. These are young red cells that have a ring of iron around the nucleus. The causes, well, there are 2 big causes. It could be due to a deficiency in vitamin B6, or it could be part of a neoplastic syndrome called myelodysplasia. On peripheral blood, you will see 2 populations of red blood cells, small red cells and normal-sized red cells. They call that a dimorphic population. On laboratory tests, you will see a decrease in serum iron. Sorry, you'll see an increase in serum iron, increase in ferritin, increased percent saturation, and a decreased total iron binding capacity of the blood. The next group of anemias are the normocytic anemias. In this category, let's go right to the high-yield ones. We'll go to sickle cell disease, 5-star anemia. For this one, you gotta know the genetics. It's a single nucleotide change. It occurs in the 6th position of the beta globin chain. Remember, there's a substitution of valine and glutamic acid. Remember that there are 2 forms of sickle cell. There's sickle cell trait and there's sickle cell disease. For sickle cell trait, remember it's about 8% of African Americans have this trait. The symptoms are less severe than having true sickle cell disease. In fact, they're usually asymptomatic unless they go to high altitudes. Last thing I want you to remember is if you have the trait, you are actually protected and resistant to infection with malaria, Plasmodium falciparum. For the homozygous patients, they have the actual disease. They have a very severe anemia, and they often have recurrent bouts. They call them vaso-occlusive crises. Let's look at some of the factors that affect the formation of these sickled red cells. One of the big ones is dehydration. on the exam. They love to give you somebody who has sickle cell, who goes and runs a marathon or plays volleyball for a long period of time. They become dehydrated. They experience a vaso-occlusive crisis. Another one is the pH. Anytime they get acidotic, that's also a trigger. Another trigger is infections. Any infection can also trigger it. Things that make it better are any disease that gives you an increased level of hemoglobin F, which is actually one of the treatments. We try to raise the hemoglobin F. Another thing that helps out is having the presence of hemoglobin C. Patients who have SC actually do better. Okay, let's look at the problems. The big problem with having sickle cells in your blood is that they tend to get stuck in small capillaries. As a consequence, you can develop infarction and ischemia of the tissue downstream. We actually call those vaso-occlusive or painful crises. These patients tend to have back pain. They're often bent over and in massive, massive bone pain. There's another syndrome called the hand-foot syndrome. It tends to occur in children, and obviously they get swelling of the hands and feet. Another big problem is you have infarction of organs, especially the spleen. And all sickle cell patients, by the time they reach their teenage years, they're asplenic. Their spleens have been infarcted, and they basically have become fibrotic, these small, shrunken fibrotic masses. So now they're susceptible to encapsulated organisms. So you've got to give these patients pneumo vaccines and the Hib vaccine to prevent infection with strep pneumo and H influenza. The other thing that's important for sickle cell patients is they tend to develop osteomyelitis with a very unusual organism. They develop a Salmonella osteomyelitis. Very unusual, except for sickle cell patients. Okay, what else? They do have an increased risk of developing aplastic crises, especially if they get infected with parvovirus B19. And finally, there are two emergencies with sickle cell. One is called the acute chest syndrome, where the sickle cells are getting stuck in the chest. That's potentially lethal. The other emergency is priapism. Okay, let's go on to the laboratory tests for hemoglobin S. The screening test is called the sickle test or sickle dex test. But the problem with that test, it's only a screening test. It can't tell the difference between sickle cell trait and sickle cell disease. To tell the two apart, you got to do hemoglobin electrophoresis. Okay, finally, the therapy for sickle cell, we usually use hydroxyurea. The reason being is that will increase the level of hemoglobin F, and that's protective. Okay, let's move on to another board favorite, G6PD deficiency. Deficiency of G6PD results in decreased levels of an antioxidant called glutathione. Without this antioxidant, your red cells are prone to lice when you're exposed to oxidants. So let's take a look at some of the different types. There's many types of inheritance. X-linked inherited African American form. They call that the A-minus form. These patients usually, obviously, are African American. They usually get exposed to some sort of drug, like an anti-malarial drug, or they could have an infection. Suddenly, they have hemolysis. They'll present with jaundice, elevated unconjugated bilirubin. The next type the board loves to ask about is the Mediterranean type. This is associated with exposure of eating an oxidant food like fava beans. So they go to the Mediterranean restaurant, they eat fava beans, they start to turn jaundiced, they become anemic, they're lethargic. It's a classic presentation. Okay, let's talk about the pathology. Because they don't have glutathione, the hemoglobin becomes denatured. Whenever you get oxidant stresses, it becomes denatured. And the hemoglobin will actually aggregate together, and it will form these bodies. We call them Heinz bodies. Now, on a normal right game sustain blood smear, you can't see them. You got to do a special stain. You use what's called a supravital stain. And in your handout, they list two of the most common ones, methylene blue or crystal violet. You got to use those stains in order to see the Heinz bodies. The other thing that you can see, they may describe to you on the peripheral blood smear, are bite cells. All a bite cell is when the red cell gets to the spleen actually takes a bite out of the cell to try and remove the Heinz body. Okay, it's just a form of a fragmented red cell. Okay, let's move on to hereditary spherocytosis. This is an autosomal dominant disorder. It usually involves one of these architectural or cytoskeletal proteins in the RBC membrane. Usually involves spectrin, that's the most common type. As a consequence, the cell can no longer maintain the nice biconcave disc shape. It will become round, and you will see spherocytes on the peripheral blood. That's characteristic. Since these cells are now spherical, when they get to the liver and spleen, they tend to be destroyed. So you develop chronic hemolysis. These patients often have jaundice. They can also develop gallstones. Last thing is, how do you make the ultimate diagnosis? Well, in the laboratory, you expose the cells to osmotic tension. Okay, the lab test for hereditary spherocytosis. The diagnostic test is you will find increased osmotic fragility. For the treatment, you want to do a splenectomy and remove the site of lysis. The next important disease in your handout is called paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. This is due to deficiency of decay accelerating factor, which is a protein on the surface of red cells. The function of decay accelerating factor is to inhibit the activation of complement by breaking down C3 convertase. Without this decay accelerating factor, your red cells are much more likely to undergo hemolysis due to the action of complement. Okay. For this disease, it tends to be activated when you become acidic, so you tend to get episodes of hemolysis when you're sleeping at night. That's why they call it paroxysmal nocturnal hemoglobinuria. The other thing I want you to remember is that PNH is a clonal stem cell disorder, so all of the blood cells are affected. Not only do you get a hemolytic anemia, but you also can get thrombocytopenia. You can also get a neutropenia and lymphopenia as well. What are the laboratory tests for PNH? Well, the screening test is called the sucrose test, sucrose lysis test. The confirmatory test is known as the Hams test. It's the acidosis in vitro test. Let's move on to the last category of anemias, the macrocytic anemias. These are characterized by an MCV over 100. The big one in this category are the megaloblastic anemias due to folate or B12 deficiency. The problem with a B12 or folate deficiency is that you have impaired DNA synthesis. So you have an asynchrony between the nucleus and the cytoplasm. That's very characteristic. It affects all cells of the body, but you especially will see it in the blood, especially on peripheral blood smears. Okay, let's talk about megaloblastic anemia due to B12 deficiency. Let's talk about the causes. It's pretty rare to occur because of dietary deficiency, because your body has a large storage. In fact, it usually takes a year at least of a poor diet. The patient population who usually gets this is strict vegetarians, because B12 is commonly found in meat and they don't eat any meat. Other causes are decreased absorption. For example, somebody who has a pernicious anemia and have destroyed the parietal cells and intrinsic factor. Other causes are patients who have intestinal malabsorption due to either Crohn's disease or other ileal diseases, or remember the parasite Diphyllobothrum latum that also loves to eat your B12 and give you a megaloblastic anemia. Now let's talk about the signs and symptoms of B12. You tend to have a sore, beefy tongue. You can have neurologic signs and symptoms. These patients tend to have tingling in their hands and feet. They can have paresthesias. They can also have loss of vibration and position sense. Finally, the lab test. How do you make the diagnosis? Well, you just look at the serum level of B12. In these patients, it will be decreased. They will also have increased levels of serum homocysteine and increased levels of methylmalonic acid in the urine. Those are all characteristic. Now, once you've determined that the B12 level is low, the next test you want to do is called the Schilling's test. If the Schilling's test is abnormal and corrected, with intrinsic factor, you make the diagnosis of pernicious anemia. Let's move our attention to the macrocytic group of anemias. By definition, the MCV will be over 100. The big one in this category is called megaloblastic anemia, either due to B12 or folate deficiency. What they both have in common is impaired DNA synthesis, leading to an asynchrony between the nucleus and the cytoplasm. It's going to affect all cells throughout the body, but it's most evident in the blood. In fact, in the blood, the characteristic finding is a hypersegmented neutrophil, very characteristic for megaloblastic anemia. Let's talk about megaloblastic anemia due to B12 deficiency first. Let's talk about the causes. Dietary deficiency is sort of rare because your body stores at least a year's supply. So it has to be a poor diet for a long period of time because it takes years to develop. Usually you see it in strict vegetarians because they do not eat meat. Meat's a high source of B12. Other causes are decreased absorption. For instance, pernicious anemia in older males. You develop antibodies which destroy the parietal cells or intrinsic factor. Another cause is pancreatic insufficiency. You need the pancreatic proteases to break down the B12R binding complex. Otherwise, B12 cannot be absorbed. And finally, intestinal malabsorption, especially due to fish tapeworms, also known as Diphyllobothrum latum. Now, what are the signs and symptoms of B12 deficiency? Well, they'll have all the signs and symptoms of an anemia. They also tend to have some unusual findings. They tend to have a beefy red tongue. They can also develop neurologic findings, peripheral paresthesias, loss of position and vibratory senses. In the laboratory, you'll find the low levels of serum B12. That's the easiest way to make the diagnosis. Other finding is you'll have an increase in serum homocysteine. In the urine, there tends to be increased levels of methanolmalonic acid in the urine. Finally, if you've made the diagnosis of B12 deficiency, the next test you want to do is the Schilling's test. If the Schilling's test is also abnormal, you got the diagnosis of pernicious anemia. Okay, how do you treat B12 deficiency? What you do is you give an intramuscular injection of B12, and in 5 to 7 days, you look for a reticulocytosis. Okay, let's go to megaloblastic anemias due to folate deficiency. Some of the major causes are decreased intake. We don't store much folate in our body, so as a consequence, you only need a poor diet for a few weeks in order to develop folate deficiency. Who gets this? It's usually chronic alcoholics and the elderly who are only eating a tea and toast diet. Other causes of deficiency are increased requirements for folate, especially pregnancy. All pregnant women should be taking folate supplements to prevent neural tube defects in the infants. Okay, finally, under signs and symptoms, they have all the signs and symptoms of anemia, but they do not have paresthesias, the neurologic findings that you'll find in B12. Finally, for lab tests, again, the easiest way to make the diagnosis is do a serum folate level. If it's low, you got your diagnosis. Okay, treatment for folate deficiency is supplementation with folate. That'll end the RBC pathology section.